You're listening to 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. We're entering the second year of the Trump presidency. He's drawn criticism from left and right over his brash style and flouting the traditions of office commonly referred to as norms. But does that really matter? For some perspectives, at the beginning of year two, I talked with Maryville College political scientist Mark O'Gorman.
As to the norms, no, there's nothing written down, but there is an expectation that once you've stopped campaigning, once you start governing, the norms are is that you're going to begin to stay consistently on message, that you're going to have a handful of major initiatives that you're going to move forward, that you're going to be presidential, and as a result, whether it's inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., or just around the country, there's an expectation that you're going to be that. However, Donald Trump came in as an outsider, if not the ultimate outsider, never had any political experience before he became president, and so I think just from that kind of campaigning, he was never going to be someone that was going to stay with the norms as Washington, D.C. defines them, not the Constitution, but just as D.C., and so not surprisingly, when a morning starts with his three or four Twitters coming forward, his way of communicating rather than waiting for the network news to say something, we shouldn't be too surprised. He campaigned outside the norm, so outside the norm governing is something we should be used to, or at least should get ready to be used to more in the days ahead.
Does it matter all that much that the president doesn't follow the norms? Because these are not constitutionally prescribed duties. Mm-hmm. These are not enshrined in federal law. They are, you and I are both baseball fans, they're a little bit like the unwritten rules
right.
of baseball. Mm-hmm. Does it matter all that much that the president doesn't follow the norms as defined within the Beltway?
No, to a point. It won't impact him, I'll do it that way, because as long as his base, as long as the people who supported him that brought him into office in this upset victory in 2016 continue to embrace his outside the norms, staying back with your baseball metaphor, if you're the quirky pitcher but you're winning 20 games, you're still going to support that pitcher. He may not be winning 20 games, but among his core supporters, those people who are a middle class, middle income folks who clearly carried him to office in more than a few rural states and rural counties, they believe that that's what they want to see. They someone fighting against Washington, fighting against the entrenched interest. And so I don't think it'll hurt him yet. It remains to be seen as we move forward to 2018 and that, to what extent the policy victories that he has or has claimed to have, whether they actually resonate with his core supporters.
Has Donald Trump done anything to reshape or redefine the presidency in his first year in a way that is substantially different than any of his recent predecessors? And we might start recent at the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm. I would say yes in two ways. One way would be maybe in foreign policy. He clearly has taken whatever the foreign policy norms or constructs are in mm-hmm. terms of balance of power and treaties and working with others as kind of a first among equals among the allies, so to speak, against any kind of threat. He clearly has upset that apple cart because he believes that everything is now on the table. He mm-hmm. believes any treaty, whether it's economic or military, any relationship with any country, those standards do not apply anymore. They have to talk with him and they have to be ready to deal actively because he believes that he wants to make a deal as strong as possible to help American interests. He thinks some of those treaties of more than a few of those alliances haven't helped the United States of America, and so he's pushed forward that way. So I think that's one, I don't know if the right word is norm, but that's one place where you're seeing the presidency change substantially in foreign policy. I would say the second one is in communication. In the same way that probably people will kind of scratch their head at FDR using that strange thing called radio in the 1930s with fireside chats, his use of social media, in spite of the grammarians listening to us who think 140 characters doesn't work, he is clearly using Twitter and social media in a way no president ever has, and successfully. Like it or not, Twitter is now the new way, at least the new format this president wants to communicate, and we just have to be ready to embrace that. How that will just impact how we think about his presidency moving forward, we're definitely going to be finding, at least in some way, via Twitter.
I guess my next question is still kind of rooted in the concept of norms, but now we're getting more into what maybe has been in federal law, or at least in the conduct of the executive branch. Mm-hmm. Since throughout most of the 20th century, for much of the last 100 years, presidents of both parties have carved out increasingly large footprints for the executive branch. And
yes.
Folks on your end of the dial, political scientists, historians
mm-hmm.
call this the imperial presidency.
Indeed.
It helps shape our impression of the president as not being one of three co-equal branches of government, but as the president, and then there are some other branches mm-hmm. of government. He is seen, for better or for worse, as a powerful figure. And that's why, as you alluded to, he gets a lot of credit when the economy is doing well and a lot of blame when it's not doing well. He's the guy that we look to in times of war or in times of conflict. And that has been an effort that has been carved out by his predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
Is something like the Trump presidency sort of a natural outgrowth of that when you have the electorate and the president acting like, well, yeah, this is what the office is. This is the power you've imbued me with.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And that kind of capacity to take the imperial presidency and then combine it with what Teddy Roosevelt used to call the bully pulpit can be an incredible megaphone for him to, for President Trump to move forward and try to make his agenda known to the world. The fact that any type of crisis, whether it was the Hawaii snafu with the nuclear alert or just any phrasing, we all turn to the White House to see what will the president say. And President Trump knows he can use that to communicate whatever he wants to help move forward on his agenda. Where I think it becomes a little bit, I don't know if it was contradiction, but you definitely see him going in two directions. Clearly, the imperialness of the presidency he wants to maintain. He wants to have that megaphone. However, at the same time, he's been actively trying to shrink the presidency around him, the Department of State and other federal agencies. He clearly wants to actively shrink. And so you find yourself scratching your head. He wants to have that huge megaphone, but at some level, you need a significant amount of government agencies, government assistance around you. Shrinking government while at the same time a loud megaphone, I'm not sure how far that can go as he moves forward in his presidency.
I was about to say, it may be important to point out then, for those of us who have had a long time since seventh grade civics, that cabinet agencies are executive branch agencies.
Yes, they are.
The president is not simply the executive branch or the White House or the vice presidency. It is a much larger portion of government, so you're exactly right about that. We'll turn to the midterm elections. The party in power, regardless of which one it is, tends to lose seats in a midterm election year. But this has been a period of, as we've been talking about, breaking norms or changing expectations, challenging the old traditions. Do you think the rule of thumb about the midterm patterns still holds, at least from where we sit? We're 10 months away and some change from election day. Or is this going to be another one of these perhaps upset years or something where the old models simply don't predict what we think might happen?
I still think some of the norms that will apply, the fact that in midterm election years, usually the president's party usually loses seats, about 8 out of the past 10 cycles that's happened. And so if you're a Republican incumbent, you're a little concerned about that. We also have like different indicators in terms of looking at presidential approval rating. If President Trump maintains a low approval rating, that might amplify the, so to speak, the punishment or the losing of seats. However, I think as the year moves forward with regard to tax cuts, the economic situation, at least from a financial point of view, seems to be relatively stable. In spite of all the rhetoric related to North Korea, we're still relatively peaceful. If that peace and prosperity theme can stay through into November, that certainly helps the Republicans and helps the Republican Trump administration move forward in the midterms. I guess an X factor is the fact that President Trump is just a unique individual. And whatever the norms we thought of, clearly he's one tweet away from busting that through, whether it's by day or by week. And so to what extent will people embrace that unconventional mechanism and say, hey, we're going to reward him in the voting booth in terms of electing people in his party, the Republicans, or whether they were going to say, no, we're done with this. Some norms will still apply, but the real X factor is Donald Trump doesn't play to the norms. And so it's going to be interesting to see.
I think it's also pretty common for the opposition party, whoever's in the minority at that point, to point to a midterm and say, this is a referendum on the president. Are midterms typically a referendum on the president and the presidency, or are there other factors at work that voters are keeping in mind as they head to the polls?
Usually we speak about, when we teach this, about use the macro and the micro. The macro is the 30,000-foot level, and usually that's where you begin to bring, even though the president is not on the ballot ever in a midterm election, he's the person people are thinking about in the voting booth. How is he doing, and how does that reflect? Do I want to vote more people in his party to help him out, or I don't like what he's doing and go in the other direction? And so you always have that. Always individual seats. Who's the candidate running in the Tennessee, like for example, in a Tennessee Senate race or a Tennessee second congressional district race? Who are those, I'll call the micro factors, the individual candidate that people are comfortable with, that they want to like see either reelected as the incumbent back into office, or that they want to embrace a challenger? And so it will always, even though we think about national issues that will clearly be on the table, the old axiom, all politics is local, are still going to play here in more than a few parts of Tennessee.
Much has been made of the current congressional members and senators who say this is their final term, that they're not running again in 2018. We're also seeing, by the way, some changeover in the Tennessee House
Indeed.
And Senate with retirements, people moving on to different jobs or running for other offices. But congressional districts and the legislative districts here in Tennessee, many other states, have been drawn to be party safe. This is a concept that you and I have talked about.
It
so
is.
That even if the current office holder steps down or leaves for another reason or leaves early or resigns, that a Republican district will reliably stay in Republican hands. Same with the Democratic district. So this year, CBS News reports it's expected that less than a quarter of the House's 435 seats in Washington would be truly competitive races. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about that. You know, people perhaps on the left would be kind of heartened to see, okay, well, Republicans are stepping down. We might have a bigger chance to change the balance of power in the legislative branch. That has a lot to do with how these districts are drawn and some other factors that are not related to individual candidates.
That's right. The redistricting occurred back around 2010, 2012. Every 10 years, the census count occurs. And from that census...
Which also means, by the way, we're not going to have another one for another few years.
Exactly. Right. And so, yes. And so whatever we did in 2010, 2012 to kind of lock in those districts, we're going to keep those through this decade. And what I mean by locking in, especially in Tennessee, more than a few of the... All of the districts in Tennessee are clearly anchored to try to assist the Republicans who were in the majority at that time and continue to be as much as possible. And so as a result, they are back coming around to the midterms. That redistricting that favors the Republicans in Tennessee should mitigate any kind of, oh, they're retiring, what's going to happen? And
right.
So how much that mitigates, we're still not certain. But that certainly suggests that that rule that even though there's 50 seats that look active, more often than not, Americans have an incredible tendency to reelect their incumbent elected officials 80%, if not 90% of the time. And so if you're a Republican incumbent, you even though you see all those retirees, you might be saying, I think there's still a chance I can be successful in 2018.
Another old saw about the presidency is that, again, and this is regardless of party, mm-hmm. the president's political power, that capital that they use to move legislation to the bully pulpit that mm-hmm. you had talked about, tends to attenuate, it tends to wane the longer that person is in office mm-hmm. from almost day one. Mm-hmm. This is something that the great legislator, Lyndon Johnson, often reminded his people around him in the White House mm-hmm. when they were like, God, you're driving us crazy. It's 18-hour workdays mm-hmm. and moving all this legislation. He said, because I used to be in Congress mm-hmm. and I know these things. The president's going to weaken pretty quickly mm-hmm. and he needs the legislative branch to get things done. Do you think that'll still be the case for President Trump? This is another one of those in the norm family of questions, but generally a president's power lessens the longer he's in office. We're now in year two of the Trump presidency. Do you think that's still going to be the case?
I think this is one of the norms will apply to President Trump for two reasons. One is the fact that usually that the phrase is the power of persuasion is the ultimate power of the presidency, regardless of constitutional duties, that ability to convince people in Congress and the judiciary to follow along with him. And so clearly the argument is you're always at your peak power in your first year and a half. And so clearly everyone in the White House knows that norm, knows that axiom, and is driving as much as they can forward with extra policy. I think that was a lot of the impetus regarding the big tax cut reform bill that happened right around Christmas. They knew that if the window was closing, if they didn't get that done that time, it'd just be tough for the Republicans to show up policy activity. What's, I think, interesting about this norm is the fact that I do think it's going to be difficult for President Trump to keep that level of energy. I think just other factors that are going to be happening, I think people are always just curious about what other issues might be occurring in the Trump administration coming down the line. There's a possibility of other investigations and things like that. If nothing else, regardless of what's going on in terms of the Trump administration, that norm rarely changes. That norm will hold. He's going to have a smaller megaphone as he goes on, no matter how much he tweets, no matter how much he tries to keep that bully pulpit. His core might still stay with him. The concern is, will that core remain at the same level? That core is considered to be about a third of the American electorate, a very vocal third. Will they still hang on beyond 18? That norm might still hold.
So. On our side of things, on the press side of things, some election years are treated like what we call horse races. It's a lot of superficial coverage. Mm-hmm. It's personalities. It's who's in front of whom. Mm-hmm. And we get down into like tenths of decimal points of opinion polling and mm-hmm. who's going to swing which way or whatever. It's a lot of inside baseball. And mm-hmm. while it can be interesting for the real wonks and people who are especially like number crunchers and interested in statistics, I'm curious for you as a political scientist, what are the major questions? We've talked about some of them. What are mm-hmm. some of the open questions, mm-hmm. the norms that have yet to be tested or patterns that we're not going to see until November if they're verified or not? What issues or questions are in your mind as we continue to watch things unfold in 2018?
I think one question I'll be looking at will be an economic question. To what extent either party, whether it's President Trump and the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, how will they convey an economic message? Clearly, as a result of the tax cut bill that was passed by the Republican Trump administration in December, they clearly hope to be able to talk about how a lower corporate tax rate and maybe an income, a tax break for middle-class Americans can help move the economy forward. So clearly that's going to be their message. Democrats will argue, wait a second, this might be just helping the rich rather than helping people that people of lesser means. And so be curious to see which one of those two economic messages take hold, whether it's at the national level or in an individual district. I think on the other side is going to be a social issue, to what extent issues such as immigration and I would say the non-economic issues, whether they gain traction. The old norm, the axiom is, usually at the end of the day, you vote your pocketbook. How am I feeling economically when you walk into that voting booth? That may not be the only one, but that sure is a big norm when you walk in. And so then the argument will be, how will those other issues, how will issues related to, say, DACA and immigration, how will other, the social norms, and I think unique language of President Trump, to what extent that will impact or create a social, tsunami that maybe will overwhelm economic issues. Those are two big issues that I'll be looking at to see what happens there. And then just to what extent will President Trump be actively involved in the races in the fall? To what extent the norm usually is a president usually helps out people in his party. I know there's still some discussion in the Republican Party to what extent they want to embrace the Trump brand. And so if they do, then clearly he's going to be in their district. If not, then maybe you'll not see him in state X or state Y. And that'll be an interesting kind of third part. So,
Mark O'Gorman is a professor of political science at Merivale College and a frequent guest here on WUOT to help us untangle the Gordian knot of politics. We hope we've helped you a little bit understand it a bit better, at least at this point. We'll check in with you, of course, later on in the year. Dr. O'Gorman, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Brandon. Good to be back.